Well, do turn with me then, please, to the passage that we read earlier on, Genesis chapters 6 and 7, as we continue our series in this book, or at least in the first 11 chapters of this book. One contemporary writer makes the following comment: "Some episodes within the biblical drama get no respect. The Genesis story of Noah and the flood certainly falls into this category. It's a Bible story, something we tell our children. Its colour, detail and action keep the kids quiet in Sunday school, but poor old Noah never quite makes it into the pulpit." And there's much truth, I'm sure, in that observation. We love to picture Noah's great shipbuilding enterprise. But can we really preach it? We find the concept of Noah and his family cooped up for so long with all those animals fascinating. But is it really edifying? These chapters of Genesis unquestionably contain compelling narrative. But do they really contain compelling theology? These are the kinds of questions that arise when we turn to this particular biblical episode. Well, I want to suggest this morning that this biblical episode, like every other, is in the last analysis telling us about God. The Bible, you remember, in its entirety is God's self-revelation. It's God's self-disclosure. And that, I think, is as true here as anywhere else within this book. And I want to suggest in particular then that two things about God stand out in this passage that we're considering this morning. And we'll take then each in turn, spending, I think, longer on the first than the second. So, first of all then, God's hatred of sin. God's hatred of sin. That stands out in this passage that we're looking at. Now, Genesis chapter 5 that we were looking at last week was a rather difficult passage to get our teeth into. You don't really have to be a thrill-seeking adrenaline junkie to find a long list of names somewhat heavy going. But for all its difficulties, Genesis chapter 5 does at least provide us with some much needed respite. Because the previous two chapters have been dominated by one terrible theme: sin. And they've given us this frightening close-up of sin's cancerous propensity to spread and to strengthen its grip and to leave in its wake a trail of utter devastation. And after witnessing then Adam's compliance with the devil in chapter 3, and after witnessing Cain's murderous field trip in chapter 4, and after witnessing Lamech's violent poetry later on in chapter 4, it's actually quite a welcome sight, isn't it, when you come to chapter 5 and all you have is a plain old genealogy. No scandals here, no atrocities here, no moral disasters here. And you can lose yourself temporarily in this list of names and numbers, and you can forget momentarily the monstrous things that human beings are getting up to. But I'm afraid the respite is short-lived. Because as we come now to the beginning of chapter 6, sin is once again under the magnifying glass. Now that may not be immediately apparent in the opening two verses. Indeed, very little is immediately apparent in the opening two verses, where we have this business of the sons of God marrying the daughters of men. And it's all very mysterious and it's all very enigmatic. But it seems to me that the key to understanding what's going on here lies in verse 3, where we have these words: "Then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with man," but the footnote reading is better, "my spirit will not remain in man forever, For he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. Now, at a most basic level, that's telling us that these marriages, these mysterious marriages between the sons of God and the daughters of men, were a bad thing. Because they prompted God to pass this sentence upon mankind. And it's a pretty drastic sentence. You recall that throughout chapter 5, we've got all these people who are living to 800 odd years old, or to 900 odd years old even. And yet here now, in verse 3 of chapter 6, God isn't simply shaving a couple of hundred years off man's lifespan. He's cutting it right back to a mere 120 years. And so, as I say, it's telling us, isn't it, that God viewed these marriages, whatever they were, in a pretty serious light, if he passed this kind of sentence upon mankind in response. But I think it's telling us more than that. Because we must ask the question, why does God here pass this particular sentence upon mankind? Why here in verse 3 doesn't God say, right, from now on, human beings are only going to have one arm? Or, right, from now on, human beings are going to eat grass like the animals? Or, right, from now on, human beings are going to be deprived the ability to verbally communicate with one another? Why didn't God go for one of those sentences? We know, don't we, that God's sentences are never arbitrary. So why then does he implement this particular one here? Why does he go for the lifespan and reduce it to 120 years like this? Well, I think the answer is that the sentence fits the crime. It very appropriately and very perfectly fits the crime. Let me explain what I mean. I take the view that the sons of God in verse 2 are angels. That's certainly what the phrase means on three occasions in the book of Job. And I think then that what we have here in verse 2 is angels, corrupt angels. And we're being told then that at this particular point in history, these corrupt angels were marrying and in verse 4, reproducing with human girls. That may seem very hard for us to imagine, but perhaps that's because we have a very caricatured mental image of angels. Certainly, those angelic visitors to Sodom, just a few chapters later on, in chapter 19, certainly they appeared to the people there as perfectly eligible candidates for sexual activity. But the important thing to notice here in chapter 6 is that these angels are marrying these daughters of men, these human girls. They're not raping them, they're not abducting them, they are marrying them. And marriage implies agreement and consent, at least on the part of the fathers of these girls. And that raises the question then, why were these fathers giving their daughters away in marriage to these angels? And I think the answer may well be that they were attempting to achieve immortality. Adam, you remember, back in the Garden of Eden, had forfeited immortality. Adam had violated God's prohibition and Adam had been banished from the tree of life. And between the tree of life and Adam, there had been placed cherubim with a flaming sword. And what we have here, I think, in Genesis 6, in these opening verses, is human beings trying to get around the cherubim and the flaming sword. Human beings sneakily trying to find a back door to the tree of life. And they're thinking like this. They're thinking, hang on a minute. If we dabble here in a bit of genetic engineering, if we breed with angels, if we introduce into the human gene pool some supernatural genes, some genes from another world, then perhaps we'll be able to defy death. Perhaps we shall be able to live forever. And that's why I'm saying then that God's sentence here in verse 3 perfectly fits the crime. It's as if he's saying, right, you're trying to outwit me. You're trying to recover by your own clever schemes that immortality which I have denied you. Well, this is what I'm going to do. Far from gaining immortality, you're even going to lose the generous lifespans you have been enjoying. Far from living forever, now mortality is going to overtake you at the young age of 120. That, I think, is what is going on in these opening verses. But even if you're not persuaded by that, even if you're not persuaded that here in these opening verses, Moses is kind of resuming where he left off in chapter 4, and once again placing sin underneath the magnifying glass. Even if you're not convinced of that from those opening verses, you must surely agree that that's exactly what Moses is doing by the time we come to verse 5. Because in verse 5 we read these words, "The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become." And the point here then is that sin in these days, or if you want to use the language of the verse, wickedness, although it's a better translation would be evil actually. Evil in these days wasn't localized. It wasn't simply confined to certain notorious hotbeds. This past week we've remembered, haven't we, the anniversary of 9/11. And you may recall how in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, George Bush talked much about an axis of evil. And by that phrase then, he meant this certain group of specific nations, North Korea and Iran and Iraq and so on, specific nations which, in his view, were particular hotbeds of evil. Well, here in Genesis 6, there's no axis of evil. Here in Genesis 6, there are no specific hotbeds. Moses isn't saying that man's evil was great in this particular place, and in this particular place, and in this particular place. Moses says that man's evil was great in the earth. The whole of the populated earth of this time, he's saying, was one great hotbed of evil. But the verse doesn't stop there, does it? The verse continues, and in the second half we read these words, "And that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time." And do you see what's going on here then? I keep reiterating, Moses is exposing here sin. He's showing us sin close up. And we've had then a focus upon, if you like, activity. What does sin actually do? And we've had Adam's fruit eating in the Garden of Eden, and we've had Cain's murder, and we've had Lamech's violence, and we've had these unseemly marriages at the beginning of chapter 6. We've had a focus upon sin's activity, what sin actually does. And then secondly, we've had a focus upon, if you like, sin's geography. In the beginning of verse 5 that we've just looked at, where is this sin? How far has it reached? And Moses is saying it's reached the whole earth. It's reached the whole populated earth of this time. And now then, having had a focus on sin's activity, and having had a focus on sin's geography, it's as if in the second half of verse 5, the focus is now on sin's anatomy. The anatomy of it all. In other words, what parts of the human being have been affected by sin? In what parts has sin taken root? And Moses is saying it's taken root in the very deepest parts. It's taken root even in man's very heart. The thought, every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. And of course, we're not talking here about that organ which pumps blood around the body. We're talking about the heart in the biblical sense, the center of the human personality. In other words then, when Adam ate that fruit in the Garden of Eden, the problem didn't reside in the hand that reached out to grasp it, or in the jaws that chewed it. It was more serious than that. The problem resided in the heart that planned it. And when Cain and Lamech, in chapter 4, murdered other human beings, the problem didn't reside in the fists that dealt the blows. It was more serious than that. The problem resided in the heart that planned them. And when, at the beginning of chapter 6 here, we have these sinister marriages, the problem doesn't reside in the lips that answered "I will" and "I do" to the marriage vows. And the problem doesn't reside in the reproductive organs that participated in this genetic engineering project. It was more serious than that. The problem resided in the hearts that planned it. And so I hope you can see then that it's absolutely unmistakable. Moses is writing about sin. He's presenting us with sin. He's giving us this great big eyeful of sin. He's showing us it with a frightening intensity and in a frighteningly close-up manner. Now, if I were to tell you that Moses' exposure of sin ends with verse 5, and that in verse 6 Moses moves on to something else, then you might think, well, that's great. Another respite, another break, another interlude. Moses is going to give us something much nicer now, much happier now, something we can enjoy a bit more. But I'm afraid it's not like that. Moses does end his exposure of sin at verse 5, for the time being at least. But what he moves on to in verse 6 is something even more solemn, something even more bleak, and it's what God thinks of sin. That's what he moves on to now in verse 6. He moves on to showing us what God's response is to human sin, and as my heading indicates, he tells us God hates it. And I just want to bring out quickly three things in connection with that. First of all, God's hatred of sin involves his very heart. It involves his very heart. Verse 6, the Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. In other words, God's hatred of sin, Moses is telling us, isn't a superficial thing. If someone says that they hate Brussels sprouts, then that hatred is merely a matter of the taste buds. If someone says that they hate the Angel of the North, then that hatred is merely a matter of aesthetics. But when the Bible tells us that God hates sin, it's a matter of the heart. We're being told that God is profoundly and deeply and inwardly antagonistic towards sin. We're being told that this hatred is bound up inextricably with his very inmost being. We're being told that his hatred of sin is this all-consuming thing. And I just want to ask all of us this morning, have we grasped that? I'm talking to Christians this morning. Have we grasped fully this hatred of sin that exists in the very heart of God? It's vital that we do it. It's vital for various reasons. I'll just mention one. You're all familiar, I'm sure, with that principle which runs through the book of Leviticus. That principle that's stated like this: be holy because I am holy. God's saying, be holy because I am holy. And that principle, of course, isn't confined to Leviticus. It isn't confined to the Old Testament. It's taken up in the New Testament by the Apostle Peter, who writes in the first chapter of his first epistle. Just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do, for it is written, be holy, because I am holy. Now, what does that mean? What does this principle mean? What does it mean to have a holiness like God's holiness? What does it mean to share the divine holiness, the divine purity, the divine separateness from all that is morally defiling? What does that mean? Well, surely it must begin at least with sharing the divine hatred of sin. Surely if we're going to be holy like God is holy, then we need to start hating sin like God hates sin. And of course, we immediately apply that, don't we, to sin out there. And we say, oh yes, I hate sin. I hate the sin that is so endemic in our society. I hate the sin that is paraded so unashamedly on our TV screens every day. I hate sin. And of course, we must apply it to sin out there. But hang on a minute, what about the sin in here? Do we hate that sin? Do we hate those favourite sins that are personal to me? Do we hate those? Can we sing with William Cowper in that well-known hymn? Return, O holy dove, return, sweet messenger of rest. I hate the sins that made thee mourn and drove thee from my breast. Do we share in this heart hatred of sin, which we see here in our God? Then a second thing in connection with this. God's hatred of sin drives him to decreation. It drives him to decreation. What do I mean by that? Well, throughout the remainder of chapter 6, then, from verse 7 onwards, we have God beginning to announce this great disaster that he's going to bring upon the earth. The flood, the deluge. And then, of course, in chapter 7, we have the actual description of that great disaster falling upon the earth. But it's very interesting that in both the announcements in chapter 6 and then the description itself in chapter 7, we have language and imagery that very much echoes chapter 1 of Genesis, the creation accounts. For instance, there's the very precise categories that are used in verse 7 of chapter 6. I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground and birds of the air. Well, doesn't that language, creatures that move along the ground, birds of the air, these precise categories, doesn't that remind you of Genesis chapter 1? Then again, in chapter 7 and verse 11, we have this concept of the waters below and the waters above. So we have the springs of the great deep. That's the waters below, and the floodgates of the heavens, the waters above. Doesn't that remind you, again, of chapter 1, where that concept is introduced? Or then even the emphasis upon 7 days. You have it in verse 4 of chapter 7. 7 days from now I will send rain on the earth. And then again in verse 10 of chapter 7. After the 7 days, the floodwaters came on the earth. And again, that's reminiscent, isn't it, of the 7 days that were so significant in the creation account. And so I'm saying we have this echoing of language and imagery from chapter 1. But there's a profound difference, isn't there? Because here the whole thing's been turned on its head. Here the whole thing is being reversed. So instead of these precise categories, the animals that move along the ground and the birds of the air, instead of them filling the earth, as in chapter 1, now they're being wiped from the face of the earth. And instead of the waters from below and the waters from above being neatly separated, as in chapter 1, now they're being merged into this great watery mass. And instead then of a 7-day process of God imposing order and structure upon chaos, as in chapter 1, now we have a 7-day countdown to chaos returning. The whole thing has been reversed, and that's why then I use this term, decreation. That's what's going on here. God is bringing about, in response to sin because he hates it so much, he is bringing about nothing less than de-creation. And it's scary to read, isn't it? But when we do so, we tend, I suppose, to kind of take refuge in words like unique and unparalleled. This is just a unique event, a singular event, an unparalleled event. We needn't worry too much about it. But is it? Because it's interesting that as you go on in the Bible, the same kind of language and imagery recurs, I think particularly of the Psalms. Psalm 46, a well-known psalm. You have reference in verse 2 to the earth giving way, the mountains falling into the sea. Or Psalm 102, and the last verses about the heavens and the earth being discarded like a garment. But again, I suppose, we take refuge and we say, well, that's all very vague. We're not really sure what the psalmists are referring to. It's just poetry and all that kind of thing. But we go on in the Bible. We come to the New Testament. We come to the epistles. And doesn't the same kind of decreation language emerge again? You go to 2 Peter and chapter 2. And Peter there refers specifically to the flood in... Sorry, it's 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 6. And then in verse 7, he says that by the same word that caused the flood, the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment. And then you move down to verse 10, and he says, the heavens will disappear with a roar, the elements will be destroyed by fire, and the earth and everything in it will be laid bare. Decreation. But now it's not vague, is it? Now it's not just poetry. Peter specifically, he puts a date on it. He puts a time on it. He says it's the day of judgment, verse 7. He says it's the day of the Lord, verse 10. It's that great day that's going to end history, that day when Jesus Christ will return. And he's saying that on that day, decreation is going to occur. And this means then that you and I can't say today, well, sin doesn't really matter anymore these days. We're not in that Old Testament situation anymore where you had this vengeful, retributive God who brought deluges when men sinned. You can't say, well, now we can be relaxed about the whole thing. Now we can sin with impunity. It's not the case. God is still going to respond to sin, and he's still going to respond to sin in exactly the same way. With decreation, Peter tells us. Only decreation now on a bigger scale than before. Because now it's not water that's going to destroy, now it's fire. Fire is going to rage through the creation, Peter tells us. And shouldn't this theme then, shouldn't Peter's solemn words make us want to sing with great earnestness what we've just been singing? Lead, Lord Jesus, my frail spirit to that rock so strong and high, standing sure mid surging tempest, safe when pounding waves are nigh, in the rock of ages hiding. Come there flood or fiery blaze, when the whole creation crumbles, rock of ages, thee I'll praise. Do you know a haven, a refuge, a safe place? When decreation occurs, are you hiding in the rock of ages? Are you clinging, in other words, by faith to Jesus Christ? But then a third thing, God's hatred of sin doesn't compromise his justice. The question may arise in your mind here in Genesis 6 and 7. Is God being over the top? Is he being disproportionate? Is he reacting too severely here, bringing about this great process of decreation? Well, I want to suggest that he isn't. I want to suggest that once again we have here God's punishment suiting the crime. Because it's very interesting that in verse 13, the disaster that God is going to bring is described in terms of ruin. We read that God is going to ruin both people and the earth. It's in the NIV, it's the word destroyed. In the Hebrew, it's ruin. I'm surely going to ruin both them and the earth. And that's very fitting, because Moses has used the same word in the previous verse, where we have in the NIV, all the people on earth had corrupted their ways. But again, it's ruined. All the people on earth had ruined their ways. So we have this word ruin twice. We have the people ruining their ways, and then we have God ruining the people. And so do you see what's going on here? That as God pours this deluge upon the earth, as God ruins the human race of this time, all he's doing is pretty much saying, well, I'm just finishing off the job you've started. You've ruined yourselves through sin. You've fed yourselves on this poisonous diet of violence and arrogance and preoccupation with the here and now. You've fed yourselves on this poisonous diet of murder and sexual immorality and sin in its grossest forms. You've ruined yourselves. And all I'm doing now is finishing the job, and I'm ruining you. And again, can't we trace that through the Bible, to the very end, to that day that is coming that we've already mentioned, when God is going to finally ruin men and women who haven't turned to him through Jesus Christ, the Savior. When God is going to ruin men and women with nothing less than hell itself. Isn't the same thing true? That it's not disproportionate. It's not God acting out of all perspective. God acting unreasonably. It's God simply finishing off the job that men and women have started themselves. They've ruined themselves through sin. And when God then brings that final ruin, he's simply saying, well, I'm just finishing the job. C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Great Divorce, writes these words. There are only two kinds of people in the end. Those who say to God, thy will be done. And those to whom God says in the end, thy will be done. And won't that be the case then? On that day when God brings ruin upon all who have ruined themselves by sin. It's simply God saying, your will be done. You've chosen this. Now you've got it. And you need to make sure then that you're not in that category, but you're in the other category C.S. Lewis mentions, who on that day will say, God, your will be done. God's hatred of sin. Well, I'm going to be very brief, just a couple of minutes on the second theme, God's plan of redemption. God's plan of redemption that we see in this passage as well. Because we're introduced to this guy Noah, aren't we, here in chapter 6. And there's something very interesting about Noah. He stands out, doesn't he? Completely. Stands out like a sore thumb. We read things like verse 9, Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time. We read at the beginning of chapter 7, God saying, I have found you righteous in this generation. We read at the end of chapter 6, verse 22, Noah did everything just as God commanded him. We read in verse 5 of chapter 7, Noah did all that the Lord commanded him. Noah isn't like the other people we've been thinking about. His heart isn't depraved like theirs are. It's not true of him that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart is only evil all the time. Here's a man who is righteous, he's obeying God, he's doing good things. And as I say then, he's standing out like a sore thumb. And it raises the question, how is this? How is Noah so different? How is Noah so distinct from everyone else? Well, the answer, is it not, is in verse 8, where we read these words, Noah found favor, it's literally grace. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And it's so important, you see, to see the order here. That we're told that before we're told of Noah's righteousness and Noah's obedience. Noah found grace with God. That comes first. And then the obedience and the righteousness comes after that. Doesn't that turn on its head the order of every religion in this world? The order of man's religions is that you do good things and then you earn the favor of God. But the order here and the order throughout the Bible is that God, of his own free initiative, bestows his favor upon people. And then as a result of that, they go out and live obedient and righteous lives. That's what we see with Noah here. Grace comes first. Grace attaches itself to Noah. Noah experiences the grace of God. His life is touched by grace. And it's then that the obedience starts. And it's then that the righteousness starts. And so God then, as he announces this deluge, he announces there's going to be an exception. This guy Noah. This man Noah, he's not going to be caught up in it, nor is his family. Noah and his family are going to be spared. And the point I want you to understand here is that the situation here isn't God kind of saying, well, I'm wanting to destroy the world here, but I've got a problem. Here's this guy Noah, and he's a good man. He's living righteously. He's obeying me. So I suppose I better do something about him. I better spare him. I better make sure that he doesn't get caught up in it all. I don't really know what I'm going to do with him beyond that, but I better make sure he doesn't get caught up in this flood. That's not what we have here. God isn't here kind of thinking on the hoof, I better spare Noah. God is here thinking long term. The deliverance of Noah is part of a much bigger thing. It's part of a much bigger plan of redemption. Just notice quickly three things. First of all, God is preserving the seed of the woman. That's what he's doing in sparing Noah, isn't he? Remember the promise back in chapter 3. God was one day going to bring from Eve's line this great conqueror who was going to crush the head of the serpent. And we've already seen in the chapter since then God's commitment to that promise already. People like Abel, people like Enoch. And here again then, even in the midst of his anger and his hatred of sin, God is still preserving the seed of the woman. He's still making sure that Christ is going to be able to come into the world. Christ is going to enter that ark. He's in the loins of Noah. Christ is going to be spared there for those 40 days and 40 nights. And here then, God is jealously and carefully and painstakingly ensuring his promise isn't going to fall to the ground. That after several chapters of it looking good, it's not going to suddenly drop. He's making sure that the seed of the woman is going to come, that Christ is going to come and crush the serpent's head one day. Secondly, God has promises to offload. You see, you might think, well, there's no evidence of the link with the seed of the woman promise. There's no evidence that driving God's deliverance of Noah here is his promise back in Genesis chapter 3. But I think there is. And I say that because of one word in the passage. And it's the word we have in chapter 6, verse 18, the word covenant. I will establish my covenant with you, and you will enter the ark. And what is a covenant in biblical terms? Well, it's God's promises, isn't it? Of course, it has obligations as well in response to the promises, but essentially, God's covenant is his promises to human beings. And God is saying then here to Noah, I'm going to establish my covenant with you. I have promises to offload upon you the other side of this flood. He's saying, I'm going to further the promise I made back in chapter 3. I'm going to give it more clarity. I'm going to expand upon it. I'm going to progress it. I'm going to advance it. Again, then Noah isn't just this person being spared from the flood because God doesn't really know what to do with him. Noah is this person to whom God is going to deliver promises that expand the original promise back in chapter 3. Of course, when we come to find out the content of those promises next time, at the end of chapter 8 and the beginning of chapter 9, we realize that they concern the preservation of the world. But why? Why is God promising that? Is he not promising that because the world is going to be the stage for this great redemptive drama that God is going to carry out? And so God then has promises to offload upon Noah. But then thirdly, finally, God is giving a glimpse of the future. Because isn't there something very precious and very fascinating about this image of Noah going into the ark with all the animals. It's emphasized again and again, isn't it? The animals will come to you, Noah. God keeps saying that. They'll come to you. Astonishing, isn't it? All these animals were going to just come to Noah so he could lead them onto the ark. And isn't it a precious picture of what man's role was supposed to be? You think back again to Genesis 1, man being made as this ruler of the creation. You think of chapter 2, man naming the animals. Man was supposed to have that kind of role in relation to the animals. He was supposed to be the head, the ruler. They were supposed to submit to his leadership. And it's a wonderful picture there, a little snapshot as Noah goes onto the ark and the animals just obediently following him. And it's such a contrast, isn't it, with the beginning of chapter 6, this genetic engineering project where creation is malfunctioning and creation is being mucked around with and boundaries are being crossed that shouldn't be crossed. Humans reproducing with angels, and it's all very messy and it's all very ugly. But here now we have this little picture of creation functioning as it ought to function. Noah in control of the animals. And is it not a little glimpse then of where this whole redemptive plan is leading, when finally the seed of the woman promise meets its culmination, when finally the covenant meets its climax, when finally redemption meets its crowning omega point. Again, man will be the ruler of the creation. There'll be a new heavens and a new earth in which the animals perfectly submit to him, in which creation functions properly. And it's not messy, and boundaries aren't being transgressed. And it's all working as God originally intended it to work. It's a wonderful little snapshot, I say, of the future for God's redeemed people. So God isn't just expressing his hatred of sin here. He's preserving the seed of the woman, making sure Christ can come. He's going to offload promises on Noah. And he's given a little glimpse of a wonderful new creation to come. Are you part of this redemption? Have you been caught up in it? By faith in Jesus Christ, can you say, I'm part of this redemption this morning? I hope you can. Amen.